Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to be talking a little bit about following your medical professional's advice relating to exercise. I've been good sometimes, and I haven't been as good at other times, and maybe you're in that same boat. We'll talk about that today with Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody. Jill, an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Jill, great to see you.
It's great to be here, as always.
And Lori is a physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. And Lori, good to see you.
Good to be here on a summer day.
Yeah. What, as you listen to these two characters talk, what stops you from following your exercise program? What physical therapy questions do you have? Certainly, they always take those as well. Join in the conversation. The number is 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Well, how common is it for your patients to not follow their prescribed exercise?
I'm trying not to laugh.
Right, right. Sometimes you become a salesman more than anything.
Exactly, exactly. Adherence is a big issue. And, you know, at the first physical therapy visit, the physical therapist, is challenged to have a conversation with the patient about what makes sense for you. You know, I have in my head as the treating therapist kind of a picture of what I think it's going to take for that person to get better, what frequency, intensity, duration of exercise, whether they need manual therapy, how many face-to-face visits, how much of this is going to happen at home. But sometimes it's a complete mismatch with what the patient expects. You know, perhaps the patient expects that they're going to be seeing me three times a week for the next 12 weeks to have me supervise their exercises. And in the old days, and Jill will acknowledge that I am the older sister, I've been around long enough where we did that, and your insurance carrier paid for you to come and see me three times a week for sometimes up to 6 months, say, following an ACL reconstruction. No more, in today's world, much of your rehabilitation happens at home on your own, and we instruct you in it, and we bring you in at a frequency we feel is necessary. But so a lot of the onus is on the patient to complete their exercises. So we try to figure out what the right dosage is for the patient to do. There's some research that shows that you probably shouldn't give patients any more than 8 exercises to do at once.
Right. And I would definitely agree with that. And I sometimes even err lower. And I think sometimes I play let's make a deal with my patients. So I have 6 or 7 in mind. How many? And I would like to get you to do them throughout the day. And I'd like you to work them into your day, because there'll be people who tell you, if I set aside a designated time to exercise, it won't happen. So how can I work these in throughout my day? So sometimes you have to compromise a little bit and pick and choose exercises that the patient you know will increase compliance if they can do them throughout the day. So you may have to modify the position your patient gets in. Ideally, I'd like you to lay down to do this exercise, but if I have to compromise and give it to you in standing so you will be more compliant, that might be a compromise we have to make.
Right, she's absolutely right. If we can figure out a way to merge our exercises into things that patients already do. If you sit at a desk, here's a way to stretch your hamstrings. If you sit at a desk, here's a way to stretch your neck or your shoulders. In between, your work's situation, stand up and do 5 squats or something like that. Interestingly, one of the things that we often do to help with compliance is to ask our patients to keep an exercise diary. Can just keep a little log of what you do and when you do it, and we can check in and see how things are going. And there was a study that came out recently that gave people a home exercise program that had leg weights for your quadriceps muscles. And what they did is they put a little accelerometer in the weight, and then they had the patient keep a log of their exercises. And then when they came back for their physical therapy visits, they asked them, you know, how compliant have you been with your exercises? So they looked at the patient report versus the log they kept versus the data from the accelerometer. And not surprisingly, the accelerator data did not correlate rate really at all with the patient report of adherence and only correlated fair to moderately with their exercise log.
Yeah. Well, 7 or 8 seems like an awful lot to have to, I mean, to remember how I think I'm thinking back to the times that I've been told to do these exercises. Usually I had 3 or 4.
Right. And that's a very reasonable number to start with. But you have to, then selection becomes very important because you want to give your patient the exercises that are going to give them the most bang for their buck. And the other important factor is it's so important that the patient is understanding why they are doing this exercise, what impairment or functional limitation this is associated with. So if your patient complains that they're having difficulty reaching overhead to get something out of the kitchen cupboard, and I give them a stretch for their shoulder muscles, I better be able to explain to them, if this muscle is preventing you from reaching overhead, if we get more length, then you'll be able to do this without hurting your low back. So I think a lot of the role of the physical therapist is not only in exercise selection, but explaining the rationale for your program design to the patient.
Right. And then, you know, in the 7 to 8 category, what happens is as the patient comes back, then they get new exercises. So the question is, do these exercises replace the old ones, mm-hmm. or are they in addition to the old ones? So sometimes when they add on, then you can end up with, I've had patients come back with pages and pages of exercises of everything they've accumulated from every physical therapy visit in their lifetime, you know.
Right.
And some of them still do some of those exercises, which is dynamite. But there has to be clarity about that. Do these replace the other ones? Are they in addition to it? And how do I make this work with my life?
Right. And just thinking about the person who, like me, who does not have a problem to deal with, but I regularly get out and do my 3 miles kind of in the morning or in the evening. We had all that rain.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so I got out of it for just a week. And then it was kind of hard to get back into it again.
It is. The first time back into an event or activity always seems to be the worst. And I always tell my patients, it's always going to be the first time back into it once. After that kind of soreness, things like that, goes away. But it is very difficult if something happens, if you get a wrench thrown in your routine, whether it's weather, people who travel, that's very significant for them because they'll have ebbs and flows in their exercise routine. It makes it very difficult for them to have consistency with their exercise.
And you bring up another really good point, Larry, and that is, as physical therapists, we need to look beyond the day of discharge.
Right.
So often we say, oh, you've achieved your physical therapy goals. You can reach overhead or you can climb the stairs or whatever the goal was. But, you know, what they did is they used to be a walker. They walked 3 miles, you know, every day, and they hadn't really gotten back to that. We need to make sure that our outcomes are sustainable beyond the day of discharge. So there has to be this seamless transition from a structured physical therapy program into those things like your regular morning walk. So there's not that gap.
Yeah.
That, you know, people fall in that gap and boom, they have a lot of trouble getting back out. So, you know, the hope would be that the physical therapist seamlessly moves you back into that routine.
In my case, my app, I got on my app and noticed that I had fallen a couple percentage in the overall. And I thought, you know what, I got to get back to do, you know, and then I got back on. But
so that's accountability. And a lot of people need some sort of accountability, whether it's an app on your phone or whether it's a group exercise class to which you belong. When you miss it, people start texting you or Facebooking you, where have you been? A lot of people do better. They have higher exercise adherence when they have a partner, an app, or somebody else that helps hold them accountable.
Yeah.
That's that social structure.
Correct.
A social structure to keep you, well, research shows that a social structure helps sustain exercise once it's initiated.
Talking today with Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum about physical therapy kinds of issues. We're talking now about sticking to your rehab program or just sticking to an exercise program. We'll take other questions as well. Certainly invite you to join in. Number is 1-800-642-1234 and email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Let's go to Gary in Eau Claire. Gary, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. This problem started in February, or the end of February, when I had a lot of wood to split. My left shoulder got sore, so I switched to right-handed swinging, and my shoulder hasn't been the same since. Eventually, in March, I went to my regular doctor, and he diagnosed me with biceps tendonitis. So I went to PT for biceps tendonitis until that was, I guess, taken care of. And then I still had pain when I was at the end. It didn't help. The meloxicam was working. When I stopped with the meloxicam, the pain came right back. So I went to another highly regarded guy in Eau Claire, and he took a bunch of x-rays and says, you have shoulder impingement and rotator cuff tendonitis accompanying it. And since I've been studying online and found out how that works. and he says, I don't need to take the meloxicam anymore. I'm done with that. And then I said, well, so what do I do for PT or anything? And he says, go back to regular exercises or do what your PT therapist tells you. So I went back to her, and she recommended I do what I was doing for the biceps tendonitis. Okay. I still have the problem. I'm back on meloxicam again. I still do some of my PT, but there are some of them that I think irritate it.
So what's the next step for Gary then?
So, Gary, can I ask how old you are?
71.
Okay. So this rotator cuff tendinopathy / impingement, unfortunately, historically takes a very long time to heal. Most people recommend 6 months of supervised physical therapy, meaning to stick with it continuously, and within that, some manual therapy. So I hear you say you were doing exercises, which is great. The question is, should manual therapy done in conjunction with it, where the physical therapist does some mobilizations first? The other thing is the sequence in which you do your exercises. So the question is, rotator cuff strengthening may be a good strategy for you, but perhaps we need to do some scapular or other exercises first.
Right, yes. And you know, exercise alone, I sort of call it the Clydesdale of things. It, you know, it's slow and steady. Eventually, you'll get there. Sometimes people need some assistance, too, from the physician. So depending upon your symptoms and what's inflamed, for example, if you have a concurrent subacromial bursitis, which often accompanies impingement syndrome, you can get some drastic improvement from a well-placed cortisone injection in that subacromial bursa. So sometimes that takes the pressure off of the rotator cuff tendon, and in the impingement syndrome, as you probably learned from reading Dr. Google, is that it includes the rotator cuff tendon as well as the long head of the biceps tendon. So there could have been some of that going on originally. So I would go back to the physical therapist and, you know, ask about some shoulder blades, some scapular stabilization, some manual therapy. And if your impingement signs are positive, are you having a lot of pain at night?
No, only if I sleep on that side.
Okay. All right. During the day, do you do pretty well with that shoulder? Or?
Yeah, I do fine.
Okay. All right. So then I would stick with the physical therapy and have those things progressed and consider a little manual therapy. And if you really get stuck, you could discuss a cortisone injection. But it sounds like it's not waking you up at night, which are some of the signs that we look for that you're not heading the right direction.
There you go. Good luck, Gary. Thank you so much for calling. Lori Tyne Brody, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our guests today, Jill Nadeau, our producer, Dave Potratz, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at all kinds of physical therapy issues today with our two guests, Lori Tyne Brody, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Lori, a physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. I'll get that out. Jill, an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW Madison. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's turn to Bill in Elm Grove. Hi, Bill.
Hi there, Larry. Listen, I'm calling for my wife, Phyllis, who is here right with me. She's a late 70s power walker, but about 10 days ago she was power walking near our house, slipped on a walnut, twisted her ankle, fell down, knee, bruised her knee and elbow, cracked a few ribs, broke her ankle. But the main thing is she wants to know when she can get back to her power walking, and she's wearing a boot now.
Okay.
That's a great question.
Yep.
So, are you under the care of a physical therapist right now, Bill's wife? Is your wife under the care of a PT right now?
She is not under the care of a physical therapist.
Right.
Okay. So I would say as soon as your physician clears you to start with some activity, the best place for her to resume activity is going to be in the pool. And I'm going to look over at Lori, and she's going to have a lot to say about that.
Yeah. So, you know, theoretically, if your wife's bone density and nutritional status supports bone healing, you know, in 6 weeks, she should be looking pretty good to go. They'll start her on a progressive weight-bearing program. Some of the issues will be the immobilization for 6 weeks. So even though her fracture is healed, two things to consider. First, she had a fall that was severe enough to fracture an ankle and fracture some ribs. So chances are she injured some of the soft tissues around her ankle as well, and they will be healing. They may take a little longer to heal than the fracture actually does. And then secondly, you have this period of immobilization for 6 weeks. The rule of thumb is it takes twice as long as the immobilization period to remobilize that joint. So you're really looking at a progression through a minimum of 12 weeks to get her ankle range of motion back and back to walking. So Jill is right that a pool is a great place for her to start recovering, because she can do her walking and work on her range of motion and get her cardio work in with a limited weight bearing. And then as she improves, she will move out of the pool and return to walking on land. But we need to make sure it's stable and that she has sufficient range of motion in her ankle, because if she doesn't, she's going to change how she walks. She's going to hurt her knee, her hip, her back on that side. So I know that was a vague answer, but I would say power walking, you know, probably 12 weeks.
Right. But there'll be other
things. It'll be 12 weeks after the boot.
After she comes out of the boot.
After she comes out of the boot.
But in the meantime, she can still be active through the pool.
Right.
They may put her on a new step or a recumbent bike or something like that. There'll be other ways that she can work her cardiovascular activity. And the other thing she will be working on before she goes back to power walking is just making sure that she has really good balance.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know people are at high risk of falls. It sounds like, fortunately, her fall was due to
A walnut.
versus just a stumble and fall. Yeah. But nonetheless, we want to make sure that she has really good balance.
And that's not to say she's not going to be back to walking before 12 weeks. But when I hear power walking, it you know, brings up a certain vision in my head of what she means by that.
Yeah.
Those darn black walnuts.
Right?
Yeah. Better black walnuts than black ice, though. Black ice is.
Yeah, even worse.
Yeah.
Bill, thanks and good luck. Appreciate your call. Fran in Madison, your turn. Hi, Fran.
Hi. I have a question. My husband has had numerous appointments trying to figure out what we can do about this very, very stiff area in his neck. Radiates up into, you know, up into behind the ear. He can't turn to the left without a lot of difficulty. He's had physical therapy. He's going through it right now, but it's not doing much to alleviate the stiffness and the pain. He, at one point, was interested in this dry needle that he heard about, but the therapist thought, well, let's try to manipulate the area, and he's doing a lot of exercises for stretching and so forth. What is your opinion when it comes to the point where this isn't helping?
So that's a great question. So dry needling certainly has its place in rehabilitation. Many times it is most frequently used to alleviate those trigger points, those knots that your muscles get. So when muscles are overworked or a certain part of the muscle is overworked, you will develop this myofascial trigger point, or that knot that you can usually palpate. When you press on it, it will send kind of sensation or symptoms, maybe some numbness and tingling, away from the trigger point. So dry needling would be used to alleviate that myofascial trigger point. In the cervical spine, when we get stiffness, many times it is due to bony changes, so degenerative changes within the bone. And so dry needling probably would not be as effective as some of the other manual techniques. I wouldn't say it would be worth a try, but I wouldn't put that up as my first line of defense in somebody who's probably got some arthritic changes and has a lot of neck stiffness.
Do you know what the origin of his neck stiffness is?
Well, it was diagnosed as a muscle that just won't respond. And the therapist said there is a spot there that is just so tough. And it will not, it just will not respond to, what would you call them, to make the muscle soft again?
Yes, yeah. To relax the muscle a little bit.
Yeah, just won't do it.
So having said that, I would say that muscle is potentially a candidate for dry needling. The big thing is in the cervical spine, you have to think about safety. So as a physical therapist who does do dry needling, there are certain muscles in the cervical spine or in the neck area that are easily accessible and are safe to dry needle. And there are other ones where you don't have a good bony backdrop behind the muscle, and then you're at risk for injuring other structures. So most physical therapists will use dry needling very judiciously in the cervical spine for fear of, you don't want to injure your patient. So if that is part of the issue, that might be the therapist's hesitancy to use dry needling.
And I've seen physicians, if it is truly a muscle and they've ruled out everything else, if it is a muscle that just won't give and that has significant spasms, they talk about Botox injections.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yep. Another thing to think about, Fran.
Right, right.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Stephanie in Wauwatosa, we go to you now. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi. I have a quick question. My son was playing football and was tackled between 3 and 4 weeks ago. And when he hit the ground, his arm went numb. Since then, the numbness went away fairly quickly, within a minute or two. And he says he doesn't have any pain or weakness in his arm, except for his elbow. He has elbow pain at night that wakes him up. Hmm. Is this something a physical therapist can help with?
So is when he fell, Stephanie, he was pretty sure he fell on his hand, and he isn't concerned that his neck got hit or got put in a funny angle, as if almost like you'd get a stinger or burner in football?
That's what he called it. It was a stinger is what he called it.
Okay. So interestingly, stingers usually come from a rapid force at the neck where the head is side bent to one side very, very quickly as you're tackled. And what it does is it puts a very quick stretch on our nervous system, our brachial plexus in particular. It sounds to me like if he's having elbow issues, is it more on the back side of his elbow, Stephanie? Do you know?
Oh, I didn't ask him.
That's okay. That's okay. Yeah. That's okay. But it could manifest as pain with that. So he would benefit from seeing a physical therapist to assess the mobility of his nervous system. And most importantly, to make sure that from a cervical spine perspective, he's got good stability and good muscle strength in his neck to prevent this from happening again.
Or an additional neck injury.
Right.
So, yeah, at this point, 3 to 4 weeks ago, he should have improved by now.
Right.
He should not be waking up with pain yet. So he needs to be seen. And if you need to see your primary first, you could do that. But this is something that needs to be seen. If it happened 3 or 4 weeks ago and he's still waking up with symptoms, it's not resolving in the time frame we would want it to.
There you go. Stephanie, thank you. Does that help?
Yes, it does. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And on to Brian in Wauwatosa.
Hello?
Hi, Brian. What can we do for you?
Well, this is an unusual question. I'm trying to find out how one would select the best doctor possible. I've got a shoulder issue. It's bone on bone. I'm 73 years old, but I'm very active. still a strong rock climber.
And
continue to do that, as well as skate ski. And so the pushing down motion isn't so bad as you would do pushing a pole in or doing a pull-up isn't so bad. Mantling is pretty uncomfortable. And there's going to be a more limited range of motion. I can tell that by how far I can put my hand above my head.
Sure.
So I need to get a doctor taking a look at it. Last time I did it, he said that there's bone on bone there, a bone spur, and tendonitis, the whole kit and caboodle all on one left side. The real question is, I don't want to be told that because I'm getting to be an older person, that comes with getting old, because it doesn't.
So your question is valid. I think a good physician, any good healthcare professional will take your age into consideration, but most importantly, your activity level or your goals. And so I hear you say that you want to find a physician that would be good for your shoulder problems. I would definitely look for somebody who is board certified in orthopedics or sports medicine. I would look for somebody who does a lot of shoulder arthroscopies. Versus total shoulder replacements, because those people, as a general rule, are usually working on a little bit more active population.
Right. I agree with that. So one of the first questions is starting with your insurance,
right,
and whether you have to stay in a network or not. And then you don't have to make any decision based upon seeing any single person. You go see somebody, you explain your situation, you see what that person has to say, and you see if you feel like you're on the same page or not. See if that person can relate to you, is listening to you, hears what you have to say, and takes into consideration what your values and preferences are. And if it's not a good match, then you move on and you try somebody else. So, but as Jill said, I agree, you need to get somebody. I would go with someone who's board certified in sports,
right?
Because you're a very sports oriented person, mm-hmm. regardless of age.
There you go. Good luck, Brian. Thank you very much for calling. And on to Dennis in Appleton. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I am wondering what the cringe factor is when a patient starts the conversation with, well, I Googled it and...
I know. It's such a great question.
Yeah.
I saw a coffee mug one time that a physician had that said, don't compare your Google search with my medical degree. So, you know, I think... Googling is just a layman's term for I looked things up on the internet. I think it depends upon the source in which you're using. There are some good sources out there. I think WebMD is a good source. Many people will turn to PubMed if they know how to do actual literature type searches and actually look into the literature with regards to their conditions. I also think there's some bad sources out there. I think you have to know the source. So when you go in to visit with your healthcare professional, I would probably not necessarily say I Googled, but through my Google search, I saw on WebMD or I saw through PubMed that da-da-da-da-da.
So I actually... enjoy when my patients come forward with something because A, I know they're interested, and B, right. For me, it's a great place to start the conversation. Otherwise, when I try to have a conversation with the patient about whatever their issue is and what the prognosis is and so on, you're kind of fishing around to figure out what the patient's level of knowledge is, what their level of interest is, like how much they care to get information. Sometimes just want to be told what to do. They don't care about information. So when they come to me with information, then we can start to have a conversation about it of, oh, well, what you read makes sense in this case. I don't think it applies to you for these reasons. And then we can move on from there. So for me, it gives me a jumping off point to have a conversation with them.
And I've had patients that have been interested in, well, could you send me, if I mention an article or a research paper, well, could you send me that? I'd be really curious as to read it. That's fabulous. I love that people are interested in their diagnosis, prognosis. And if I can send them rich literature, that's fabulous.
And what are the two sites you mentioned once again?
Oh, I just off the cuff mentioned WebMD, which I think has some good layman's terms appropriate medical information. And then the other thing is through
PubMed,
the National Institutes of Health. It's PubMed, and it's the literature that's been published by and peer-reviewed.
Right. Yeah. And Mayo Clinic has a good website,
Mayo
too.
Mayo Clinic has a great website.
Yeah, in this area, a lot of people like to go to Mayo and respect their information.
Yes, I agree.
So there you are, Dennis. Well,
thanks for that great question.
Yeah, that's a great question.
Do you have experience with that?
No, but I have a friend who is a nurse, and she cringes every time she hears that.
Okay. There you go. Yeah. Well, we've got some good information out based on that question.
Yeah, it really was.
It's
so
a really,
really
good question.
Appreciate it. Yep.
Stephen Hayward has something for us. Hi, Steve.
Hello there.
What can we do for you?
Well, I'm another aging athlete with that's been sidelined. I had a hip replacement, full hip replacement, about a week ago.
Okay.
And so I'm recovering from that. But I was out roller skiing and I made a mistake. But anyway, I'm curious. My perception since I've gotten back on this thing, and I've talked to my surgeon about this, is that the new hip may be resulting in a longer leg length than I had before on that side.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought this up, and he said, well, I wouldn't get too worried. I said, can we measure this? And he said, well, I wouldn't get too concerned about that until you've given it 3 or 4 months of adjustment because your pelvis will adjust. And that does not jive with anything I've ever known in my coaching career with skiing or my own skiing or people that I've worked with or heard from. So I just wanted to run that by you guys. Is that good information, or do I need to get the make sure I'm starting from a level platform in order to get this thing to heal right, line up right?
That's a really interesting question because I see that all the time that patients come in and they've got this leg length difference. So there's a couple ways to look at it. One is when I look at it mechanically, I cringe because I say you're no longer symmetrical and the way you've walked and moved your entire life has been drastically changed overnight. Now, that being said, there is a subset of patients whose body will adapt to that. And they'll you know, go through a little period of readjustment, and lo and behold, they'll come out on the other side just fine. There's also a subset of patients, particularly those who may have pre-existing back problems or knee problems, where all of a sudden you throw the mechanics off a little bit and the wheels come off everywhere. So that's the long answer to your question. The short answer to your question is I don't know where you're going to fall out on that continuum. If in a couple months your body will have adjusted and you'll go on your merry way just dandy, or if it'll start this downward spiral of new problems.
Right. And I do agree with Lori that I don't think you need to make the decision right now. And I think you should kind of see how things shake out. If you do end up with a leg length discrepancy, as Lori said, some people do. As a general rule, the most we ever correct for is about half of it. So if we're talking about a change, it's probably not going to be that big. The other thing I will tell you is when you measure for a leg length discrepancy, which you can do, it's the measurement, the intra and inter-tester reliability are awful because you're doing it by bony palpation. So I'm going to palpate a couple bones on you and I'm going to run a tape measure down your leg and I'm going to measure. So unfortunately, the measurement that we have for it is not great. So a lot of times we'll go on subjective input, like Lori had mentioned, if people are still having difficulty with things, they still feel like they have a discrepancy. And then what we usually do is correct for half of it at most.
And if when we're talking about leg length differences, are we talking about a quarter of an inch, a half an inch? What is the typical?
Somewhere in that range is probably usually.
A quarter to a half inch?
Yes, it's usually not more than that. But yeah, it can be that. And there's a certain amount, I think you can correct for up to 3/8 of an inch inside your shoe. And after that, you have to go out of your shoe.
Yeah, I see people who have 1/2 to 3/4 of an inch leg length differences after their surgeries.
Okay. Yeah,
there we go. Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it. By the way, you can join in with your physical therapy question at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. Diane in La Crosse, it's your turn. Hi, Diane.
Good morning. I'm a healthy woman in my late 60s. I have been diagnosed with bicep tendonitis on my right side, and this is due to an injury. It was 2.5 years ago, and since then I've doctored on and off with it. It seems to get somewhat better, and then it acts up again, and it will wake me up. I've seen a physical therapist and also an occupational therapist, and like I said, it seemed to be better, but then now it's flaring up again. There is somewhat of a tear on that tendon that was shown on an MRI. Now I'm seeing a different doctor and will be going to physical therapy. The doctor talked about dry needling and also an ointment that should help the healing. I am wondering what kind of a time schedule I should be looking at, and what are some questions that I should be asking at this point?
All right.
Well, those are all really good questions. Can I ask if you feel like your ebb and flow is related to exercise or changes in your exercise or adherence with your exercise, anything like that, Diane, since you've seen so many healthcare professionals?
I don't think there's any correlation with activity level.
Okay.
So, and this is all in your long head of the biceps tendon?
Yes.
Okay. And so you have no idea what brings it on and what makes it get worse?
I know that, generally, no, I don't, except that what will bring on pain is to rest my arm in the palm up position for a time, mm-hmm. and then I feel the pain in the inner part of my elbow and also in the forearm mm-hmm. bone that would be above my little finger.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So has one of the things you can do, so when you have this chronic bicipital tendonitis, first of all, you would ask some questions. What would be good questions to ask your therapist? I think being able to explain this history that you have just explained to us is great. If you can delineate things that increase your symptoms or decrease your symptoms, those are both very helpful things that a physical therapist would like to hear. Also, your demands. So your activity level, your job demands, all of those things would be helpful. And then lastly, Lori and I were both just curious if anybody had discussed either a tenodesis or a tenotomy with you at the long head of your biceps.
No, and I don't know what that is.
So did the doctor talk about cutting and releasing your long head of your biceps?
He said that surgery would be the last option, and he's not recommending it.
Okay. Yeah. So there are many people who undergo that procedure. People who have, for example, chronic bicipital tendinopathy that's causing shoulder pain and upper arm pain. It's not uncommon to have that surgery, and it does relieve pain. It's particularly if it's your non-dominant arm. Also, just for the record, the long head of your biceps is not your primary elbow flexor. You know, when you think of Popeye and bending your elbow and using your biceps and doing a biceps curl, it's not actually the long head of your biceps that's the primary elbow flexor. So you don't lose a tremendous amount of strength by that procedure. So I guess when I went to my physical therapist, I would explain what things had been done and what worked and what didn't work, because you don't want to keep repeating the same cycle over and over and over again. You want this to go away. So figuring out what are the things that work, what are the things that don't work, so you don't continue to repeat this cycle over and over again would be key.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Visiting today with Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Lori, an athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Give a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, looking at all kinds of physical therapy issues with our two guests, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Our lines are all filled. We've got several emails here, so lots to do. Let's get to it. And Leah in Racine, we go to you. Hi, Leah.
Hi, guys. I was just wondering, so at 28, which was last year, October 6th, I herniated my L4 and L5 disc. I have been to a specialist in La Crosse and have had two cortisone shots and a steroid shot to start. It's gotten me to about 60% mobility, but now that I'm in a different healthcare system, I haven't found a physical therapist yet, and I was just wondering what I can do in the meantime, being so young, to try to control this issue.
Oh, what a great question. So did you get physical therapy when you were in your previous system and you were getting all these injections?
No, I didn't. I only had two injections. First one was right after I got the MRI, and the second was about 3 months later, so probably December.
Okay. So what can you do? Well, I would say the first thing you should do is find out who you can see in your new healthcare system, because there are exercises, there are different exercises for different evaluations of a disc herniation. So not all disc herniations herniate the same direction, nor do they present the same way. So some people do well with what we call flexion, where you bring your knee to your chest. Some people do better with extension. Say you're on your stomach and you press up into extension. So, you know, saying to you, well, you should do this or that may not be in your best interest. So I would say getting to see somebody would be key. In the meantime, walking. If you can go online and learn how to do a transversus abdominis muscle contraction or a pelvic tilt to tighten your lower abdominal muscles to provide some support for your low back, that's a good activity. But generally being active, avoiding sitting would be the recommendations.
Right. Frequent position changes seem to be of most benefit. And if there's a way you can kind of keep track of, oh, this position I feel better, this position I feel worse, whether it's I feel better when I sit, I feel better when I stand, I feel better when I lie down, then you can start thinking about kind of incorporating that into your activities. So for example, if you do better sitting than standing, you might want to try exercising on a stationary bike. If standing and walking is better, then you implement a walking program. So try and kind of log those things a little bit so it will help your therapist and you kind of guide your program into what we call directional preference, which is what Lori was getting at. Would you do better with a flexion program or an extension program?
Right. And generally being active is going to be great. But as Jill said, keeping track of what works and what doesn't work. And when you see the physical therapist, that therapist will do an assessment and see what your movement limitations are. Are you limited in certain directions? Are you having difficulty with certain activities? And then they will design a program to help you bridge that gap between where you're at now and where you want to be. And they will use certain exercises or activities to help get you there. But it's a really relatively individual thing. Not all disc herniations are the same, and you're only 29 years old. So your program's going to look different than somebody who's 69.
Yeah. Leah, I hope that helps.
It did. Thank you so much.
Yeah,
good
thanks.
Luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Jim in Cleveland, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. 2 years ago, I was diagnosed with a brain tumor and went through treatment of chemotherapy and radiation. And one of the side effects that I'm experiencing is neuropathy in my feet. Now, before I went into treatment, my wife and I often would go for walks, for a 5K walk. And now I can't walk without a walker. Because I just don't feel I trust myself that wouldn't have balance. So I'm wondering, can I look towards a time when I won't have the neuropathy in my feet or numbness in my feet anymore, and I can just walk without a walker? Would exercise help that?
That's a great question. And unfortunately, neuropathies in the extremities, whether it's the feet or the hands, are many times a side effect of chemotherapy. And I have friends who are in kind of the same situation as you do. One of them tells me that every time he takes a step, he feels like his socks are balled up under his feet. So I hear you say that it's physical therapy in particular won't reduce your neuropathy. Physical therapy exercises could help get you stronger. They could help with balance, And you could also potentially find another way to walk that's safe. The first thing that comes to mind for me would be ski poles.
Mm-hmm. Walking poles.
Walking poles, exactly. So I think seeing a physical therapist to see if we can do some strengthening exercises in your lower extremity, some good balance and proprioception, and then see how you do with some ski poles might be a solution for you.
Right. So the strengthening exercises would be good for your legs because you can compensate some a little bit farther up your legs, but also really working with someone on a balance program who can help you improve your balance and improve your confidence in your balance so that you might be able to walk with ski poles.
Right.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck, Jim. Thank you so much for calling. William emailed to ask what you recommend for piriformis syndrome.
So the piriformis is a small muscle in your butt, and the sciatic nerve passes underneath it, and there are anatomical variations for some people. It passes through the piriformis muscle, and you may hear people talk about having this piriformis syndrome, and they have difficulty sitting because you're sitting right on that muscle and right on that nerve. So if indeed the primary culprit is that muscle and that muscle is tight, we typically do stretching exercises for that, a lot of stretching around the hip. We look at your posture and how you move. Perhaps you need flexibility on the other side of your joint because you're overloading that one. We talk about how you sit and modifications to your sitting posture to take the pressure off the piriformis. We'd also do an examination to make sure that the piriformis pain is actually originating there and not coming from your low back, because
right.
that's a classic place right. for an L5 disc to refer pain.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, and the only other thing is some people use their piriformis. They overuse the muscle because they have weak gluteal muscles. And so that's, again, something else a physical therapist could examine to determine what the source of symptoms is, like Lori said, and then any contributing factors that may be going into that.
And if you're not opposed to having someone sticking a needle in your butt, I believe you've used dry needling for this.
I love to needle a piriformis.
I know you do. That's why I brought it up.
It's got some lovely trigger points, and it's a nice way to jumpstart a piriformis syndrome rehabilitation type of program.
There you go, William. Thank you.
The nice thing about needling a piriformis is the patient can't see the needle.
I wouldn't look even if I could
I
see it. Barbara in Appleton, hi.
On April 1st, I had surgery. It was like an anchor or something they did. Open treatment of my broken forearm bone at the elbow. So what I have is when I touch my right elbow, I have this normal feeling, but it happened to my left elbow, so I can still feel the little hole in it. But I don't know if that's normal for me to feel the little hole in it, but when I put my elbow down on the counter, it just has like a jet sting. And I did go through therapy, and the therapy makes my arm stronger and everything, but why can I feel a hole there? Doesn't the bone come back together? And the doctor did say that I might be back to see him to remove something that was put in. Is there something in there that when I put my elbow down, or should I just go back?
Well,
you know, it's been about since April 1st, and I don't know if I should go back to the doctor.
The short answer to that is yes, because you seem to have a lot of questions that a physical therapist would probably have difficulty answering in the absence of x-rays of your elbow. But if you fractured it and they fixated it with screws, you may be feeling a small indentation or something around that screw head. And because the elbow bones are so superficial, you don't have a lot of fat or muscle over them, it's really easy to feel every little bump and nodule there. So if you are feeling that and it's bothering you, I go back and see the doctor and ask he or she those same questions.
Mm-hmm. Yep. There Agreed. You go. Thanks for calling in. Brian in Portage. Hi.
Hello there. I've got a little history for you. Earlier in the show, you talked about, there was a fellow talking about getting had his hip replaced and the length of one leg to the other. 50 years ago, I had Perthes disease as a child, and now I'm in November, I'm going to have my right hip replaced. Well, my right leg has always been shorter. Will it possibly be the same length now? Could it be?
Maybe. You might be even.
Correct. Yeah, let us know.
I've walked like a penguin for 50-some years, so...
People won't recognize you walking down the street.
Yeah, but you will have the same issues that people who now used to be even and are uneven will have because your body's been used to it for 50 years.
Right.
So you just have to be cautious about changes in the mechanics of those joints as you recover from that surgery. You might like to start out in a pool so you don't have full weight bearing on that and see how things shake out.
Right, you'll want to see how the muscles and your joints adapt. So they may adapt just fine.
Yeah, so that's could be a positive.
Yeah, that's really, who'd have thought? Exactly.
Yeah, well, Brian, you're going to have to let us know after that surgery is over, because Lori and Jill come back every month, as a matter of fact, to talk with us. Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. And they'll be with us till 12:30. We'll take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back. You stay with us. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here visiting about physical therapy issues today with our two guests, Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist, athletic trainer at the UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at the UW. Great to have them along. Questions for them, give a call at 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Lydia in Mount Horeb next. Lydia, thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Thank you for taking my call. I have Morton's neuroma in my left foot, and I've had it for 11 years, and the pain flares and, you know, dies down different times. But I was... wondering if physical therapy would have any advantage. I've never
tried that, huh? Okay.
Well, that's a great question. And although physical therapy won't remove your Morton's neuroma, that kind of ball of nerve and scar tissue between your toes, there are things that physical therapists could do that may help develop some strategies for you. So it would be important to make sure that you had adequate mobility in your ankle and all the bones around your feet. Make sure that you have really good strength within your foot, especially what we call your intrinsic muscles. And then the other thing that a physical therapist could help you with is recommendations on footwear, because we want to make sure that you're not wearing shoes that have too narrow of a toe box that will kind of compress that neuroma between your metatarsals.
So have you been seeing someone for this, a podiatrist or someone, or have orthotics?
No, I have not. When it was first diagnosed, I was referred to a podiatrist, but that was not helpful.
Okay. All right. So seeing a physical therapist to examine your foot and ankle to see if there's any deficits in your mobility or strength that could help decrease your symptoms would certainly be reasonable. And if you said that, you know, your symptoms have come and gone over the years, if you could try to outline or think about what made your symptoms worse and what makes them better, that would be helpful information as well.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling.
Yeah, that's a tough problem.
Yeah. Mary emailed to say she was diagnosed with compartment syndrome in the lower legs, had surgery in 2005. She's been diagnosed again for lower in the same compartment and in a different compartment. Are there any long-term solutions other than surgery? She's a triathlete, noticed this most while biking and running.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So there are four compartments in your lower extremity, and when the muscles expand and there's no place for them to expand because the compartments are all wrapped in a fascia, which I equate to Saran wrap, what happens is a nerve can become compromised, the nerve that's also in that compartment. So you can go in and get those compartments released. So long-term solutions other than surgery, if she has not seen a physical therapist, I would definitely recommend seeing a physical therapist for some soft tissue mobilization, appropriate stretching, and then to look at her mechanics when running and biking to see if something can be done to offload those compartments. Perhaps her bike setup or how she is running could be impactful, particularly if she only has it in one leg. Then you right. always wonder what's different side to side.
Exactly, yeah. exactly. Because in biking and running both legs are doing the same thing. So what is it about her anatomy, about her posture, about her mechanics that's overloading that one compartment? So finding the answer to that question may help her as much as anything.
Right.
Let's go to Nancy in Three Lakes, Wisconsin next. Hi, Nancy.
Hello.
And what's on your mind today?
I have a question about plantar fasciitis.
Yeah.
I have it in my right foot, and I've had it probably for about, off and on, for about 6-7 years. And initially, when I saw a podiatrist, I went through physical therapy with stretching exercises, standing on a stair, and lowering my heel. Below the stair tread and those types of things. And I've gotten inserts for my shoes, but I used to enjoy walking, and I have now taken to bike riding and working out on an elliptical, because walking, even with those things, causes the either side of my heel to bulge out and be inflamed for a week or so after exercising by walking. The other thing that's helped me is night splint mm-hmm. on that foot, so that I don't extend my foot and mm-hmm. I don't have the pain in the morning. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if there's anything new in the physical therapy area that I might try.
Well, Nancy has done a very good job of covering all of our conservative interventions in the world of plantar fasciitis. So a night mm-hmm. splint is a great strategy. It sounds like she's stretching. She has inserts. She's done some activity modification. The only thing I would suggest, I don't know, you had mentioned that you had seen a physical therapist, I believe, initially when you were first diagnosed, but it wouldn't be a bad idea to see a physical therapist again to see how you have changed. So there are a few interventions that are new. Dry needling might be something that would be of benefit to you if you have a lot of myofascial trigger points or knots, particularly in your soleus muscle, which is a deep, deep muscle, which you use for gait and walking. And then let's see how you've changed. So perhaps there are other structures that have gotten tight. Maybe your ankle joint needs some mobility. Maybe somewhere up the chain there could be a contributing factor that has changed in the last 6 or 7 years in order to kind of modify or change your program to best suit you.
Right. So very often people are doing an exercise program or doing a rehabilitation program, and then now it's several months or even a couple years down the road and things have changed. That program needs to be updated. And I expect you've probably done the classic massage techniques mm-hmm. with the tennis ball and things like that, and that the stretching you're doing is plantar fascia specific. So sometimes people just get calf stretching, which isn't really specific to your plantar fascia. So you want to make sure you're doing the plantar fascia stretching that has your toes extended mm-hmm. up or back.
There you go, Nancy. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Angie in Green Bay emailed to say she started running in June and has worked her way up to about a 5K by running every day. About a month ago, after feeling a little tense in her legs, her left calf just cramped up and she couldn't massage it out. She's been taking it easier, but the cramping still comes and goes. Is there an exercise or stretch or diet change that would help? She tries TENS therapy, but it's somewhat painful.
Well, you know, that's interesting that, again, that it's like Mary in one leg.
Right.
So you have to wonder what's going on when you have those symptoms in just one leg. So, you know, the things that we think about, you know, A, is she running on a bank surface, which could be part of it. But cramping is a different symptom than pain that people have. And when we think about cramping, we think about vascular or neurologic issues. So the cramping could be similar to Mary's compartment syndrome, but could also be coming from her back. So we would want her to be evaluated for that. I don't think any diet, exercise, or stretch would be the first line of defense until she has been really thoroughly examined and finding out what the cause of the cramping is.
Absolutely.
Dan emailed to say that during the pregnancy of their first child, his wife's feet became very sensitive with numbness, tingling, sensitivity with touch, very painful. She's been to chiropractors, neurologists, tendon ligament specialists with no relief. And this has been going on for about 2 years now. Any ideas as to what might be the issue there?
Wow. I have never heard anything along those lines. It wouldn't be related to gestational diabetes, do you think, Lori?
Well, that her doctor should have picked up on
right.
that if it was
right.
diabetes. But the other thing that comes to mind is that if she's hypermobile, it could be coming from her back. And I'm not sure if the neurologist was a spine neurologist or if it was a general neurologist who might have been looking for multiple sclerosis or some systemic neurologic injury or neurologic problem. So the one thing that I see that tends to be overlooked is this underlying hypermobility, which could have flared during a pregnancy.
Right.
If she has not seen a physical therapist who specializes in women's health, that's where I would go next. Because some of the professionals she's seen look to rule out, you know, disease or things like that, but she may be missing the piece of the women's health specialist who looks at kind of the whole woman, the pelvic floor, the hormonal changes with pregnancy, who may look at this problem through a different lens.
Right. I agree.
All right. We turn back to the phone and to David in Milwaukee. David, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to know what your guests would suggest for me as an alternative to the suggested fusion surgery on my neck. I have been diagnosed with stenosis around C6, C7, and I've seen the MRIs and they've done an EMG. The investigation stemmed from me having shingles earlier this year and temporary numbness in my left hand. I had shingles on my back and underneath my left arm. And the original numbness, they said that's shingles affecting your nerves. It may go away shortly, longly, or never. And after a month or two, they said, we better look further. And that's when they did the EMG and the MRI. And they showed me the pics and said, these discs are pressuring around your spinal cord. So we suggest surgery and fuse that. And my life has been a triathlete and as well as other things, so I kind of shy away from getting fusion. So I wonder if there's anything as far as therapy or activities that I might do to help alleviate that.
So is it central stenosis? Did they talk about that it being pressing on your spinal cord? Or was
yes.
it? Okay.
Okay. Yeah. So if it's central canal stenosis, and just for the listener, central canal stenosis is different than foraminal stenosis. So foraminal stenosis is like when you get sciatica, you get pressure on the nerve root as it exits this spinal cord itself. When you have central canal stenosis, you have a disc herniation that's pressing inward onto your spinal cord itself. Physical therapy has been used to treat different kinds of stenosis, and depending upon how severe your central canal stenosis is, sometimes a fusion is the best way to go. If you haven't had any physical therapy, you can certainly ask for some. Physical therapist can take a look at it and see if he or she can help. fusing in your neck is not quite the same as a fusion in your back, because it doesn't carry as much of a load. It only carries the load of your head. So in contrast to your low back, which carries the load of everything above it. So you'll turn out a little better with a fusion in your cervical spine than you would in your lumbar spine in terms of progression. So,
and it sounds like they're talking about a single level fusion. So if it's just a single level, that's an entirely different thing than talking about a multi-level fusion. So I think you have a couple things going for you, for sure.
So, you know, it's one of those borderline issues where physical therapy may help. That disc herniation is probably going to remain there,
right,
and probably going to continue to put pressure on your spinal cord. And given how active you are, you know, you're at a higher risk of having things turn south.
Right.
Good luck, Dave. Thank you so much for calling. Maureen in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Maureen.
Hi there. I fell several years ago on the ice and twisted my one knee and hit on my hip, or hit on my butt, and now I have avascular necrosis and a collapsed hip joint.
Oh.
But I don't have any pain in my hip joint, but I do have atrophied glute muscles.
Sure.
And so orthopedic surgeons go, well, because you don't have the pain and because you have weakened muscles, we hesitate to give you a new hip because then you could have pain, or we could injure your muscles and then you could end up in a wheelchair. Well, in the meantime, I try to exercise as much as I can, but my other joints are starting to kind of change, enlarge, and hurt from compensating.
Right.
And I'm wondering, is there any kind of like non-traditional, I was looking at like Feldenkrais or some other kind of stuff that might help me move better or strengthen myself?
That's a great question, and you're right. I mean, we're so grateful you don't have a painful joint, but at the same time, you have to start thinking about the overload that's going on adjacent joints. So you start worrying about your SI joint, your low back, and your knee. So we don't want those to become factors or problematic. So have you seen a physical therapist at all for this, Maureen?
Right. I've seen several.
You have? Okay.
The therapies don't really do anything.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Well, yeah, I mean, we have an anatomical change here, which is part of the problem. So I don't know. I think a good place for you to exercise might be the pool, because mm-hmm. we don't have to worry about as many muscle imbalances, or the unloading would help her.
So the physician says no hip replacement because you don't have pain?
And also because I have some apparently atrophied glute muscles, and if he moves them, well, I actually have seen five different surgeons.
Okay.
If they move them, then you could get... the muscles could be injured and I could end up in a wheelchair.
Okay. So you have a consistent message from
right.
all the physicians you've seen.
Pretty much, yeah.
Unfortunately.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, then I think your option, as Jill said, probably is the pool. It's a great place to exercise and it won't put as much load on your adjacent joints. So,
and the Feldenkrais method that you had mentioned it's an awareness through movement, kind of movement strategy. And I certainly think that that would be appropriate for you as an option as well.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go, Maureen. Thank you so much and good luck. Mary in Fitchburg, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I was listening and heard the lady that had the Morton's neuroma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
My husband actually has that, and it was at least 7 years ago, and we saw a sports medicine podiatrist in Jackson, Mississippi. The previous doctor we had seen said that they wanted to operate and take it out, and she said no. Mm-hmm. What she did say was to build a little ramp that was at a 45-degree angle so he could keep his feet pointed up at the 45-degree angle for like 30 minutes a day or twice a day.
Mm-hmm.
And she also gave him these little teardrop-shaped pads
mm-hmm.
to put on an insole.
Yep. That's a metatarsal pad, yes.
Yep.
Okay, yes. So I just wanted to mention that because instead of surgery, that ended up helping. And he, you know, if it starts to act up again, he just has to do those things and it's so much better.
That's great. That's wonderful.
So that's perfect.
Thank you for sharing.
Yeah, that's the stretching that we talked about. Mm-hmm. So the ramp is it's a little angled board, a little incline board that he just stands on and stretches his calves. So that's a great stretching technique. It's easy to do, especially if you're a little bit handy. You can build one of those. And then the metatarsal pads, you can buy those at any drugstore. For some people, the metatarsal pads work. They sort of open up the space between those toes. For other people, it just annoys the neuroma. So you kind of have to try them yourself and see right. if it works in your shoe. But thanks for sharing that.
Yeah,
that's
thanks
great.
A lot. And Leanne called in to share something. She has a stiff neck like a listener called in about. And deep tissue massage did the trick for her. So the deep tissue massage was something that worked in her case.
Yep, that's great.
And Carol emailed to say she has bone on bone in her knee, that her doctor said she could get a cortisone injection to help with the pain. Is getting a cortisone injection just masking the pain, which could then just worsen the bone on bone because she may do more than she should?
That's a great question. So a lot of times corticosteroid injections in the joint, if used appropriately, are very helpful, particularly when their patient symptoms are so severe such that they cannot exercise and they cannot perform a strengthening program. So if Carol would choose to get a corticosteroid injection and follow that up with appropriate mobility and stretching exercises and strengthening exercises, so the bones could be offloaded a little bit by an increase in muscle strength, I think that would be a good use of a corticosteroid injection for her.
Right.
And Dave in Wanakee, what's on your mind?
Oh, Larry, thanks for getting me on the program. I always enjoy your show. I've had issues the last few years in my lower back, L5-S1, with herniated discs, and that's kind of healed up. And I've had other issues recently. I've had an MRI done that showed the back was stable, but just in the last week, the sides of my feet and both feet are semi-numb, kind of from the heel forward where that bone protrudes. I'm wondering if I don't have any new injuries showing up on the MRI that I had done last week, what else might be causing that numbness on the sides of my feet and both feet?
Well, it still could be coming from your back,
right?
Because there's no new disc herniation, but the reason you get sciatic symptoms is usually due to inflammation in the area. If you have facet disease, for example, in the presence of an unchanged disc herniation, that swelling in the area can cause pressure on the sciatic nerve and can give you sciatic symptoms, which can manifest as that. So even though there was no change in your back, it doesn't mean that there isn't some subtle inflammation there that is causing some pressure on the nerve root that's causing symptoms.
Right. And the other thing you always have to remember about an MRI is they are done with you unloaded. Mm-hmm. They're done with your spine unloaded. And so how things change when you stand up and that disc gets a little bit compressed, we don't really know. And so you may look beautiful lying down, but there may be some changes that happen when you start putting pressure on that disc, which may in turn result in those symptoms that Lori talked about.
So if you haven't seen a physical therapist, going to see somebody and getting some activities, one of the things they would do is see if they can find positions, postures, or activities that relieve the symptoms in your feet. And that gives us information about what could potentially be going on in your feet.
And there you go, Dave. Thank you so much for calling in. Lori and Jill, thank you. Here we are out of time, and you will be back on October 15th.
That sounds great.
We'll do it all over again. Thank you.
Thanks.
Lori Tyne-Brody, physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW Madison. Tomorrow we'll talk about infant mental health, and at 11:45 about the latest treatment and research for atrial fibrillation. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.